Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Dear viewers, from today I begin this lecture series on the collection and transmission history of the Quran. It is primarily based on a 15-year-long research, part of which also formed my doctoral thesis. It primarily owes its inception to the questions that arose in my mind when I taught this subject to postgraduate students, and I taught the conventional view on the collection and transmission of the Quran. And then as I taught and studied this subject, more questions arose in my mind, and I made a commitment to myself that I shall try my best to find out the truth behind these questions. Today in this session, I shall present some of the important questions which arose in my mind 15 years ago, and I shall also try, inshallah, to sum up these questions as best as I can, and then in the later episodes of this topic, I shall also point out the research methodology, my objective, and a summary of the topics that we shall discuss later on. But first, as I said, in this session, I'll present before you the questions which arose in my mind at that time. The first question which arose in my mind when I began studying and teaching the subject was that currently there are 5 different versions of the Quran found in the Muslim Ummah. Now, this might be a startling revelation for most of you, but then for academic circles, this is nothing new. So we have 5 different versions of the Quran circulating in the Muslim Ummah. We have this famous version, or I would say the riwayah of Hafs from Asim, which is the Quran, which is taught in most parts of the Muslim Ummah and which is known to most of us. And these Qurans, as I would point out, are actually named after a famous reciter who used to recite the Quran in a particular way. And when I say reciter, it does not merely refer to pronunciation. It also refers to variation in words. So when I say there are 5 versions, it means that there are 5 different versions which have different words at times. There are verbs which are different. There are nouns which are different. There is a difference between plural and singular. There are differences between declensions or the i'rab. And then we have other differences as well. So the first of these Qurans, as I said, which circulates in most of the Muslim Ummah, is called the Riwayah of Hafs from Asim. And the second of these versions is called the Riwayah of Warsh and Nafi. And this is also, this Quran circulates in most parts of Morocco and Algeria, and almost all of, in fact, Morocco and Algeria read the Quran on the Riwayah of Warsh from Nafi. Warsh and Nafi, and as I previously said, Hafs and Asim, all these are reciters. Hafs is the student of Asim, and similarly, Warsh is a student of Nafi. And Asim lived or died in 127 Hijra, and Nafi himself died in 169 Hijra. The third version of the Quran, which is prevalent in most parts of Libya and Tunisia, it is called the Riwayah of Kalun from Nafi. Now, Nafi, again, he had 2 students. The previous version was from Warsh, and this is from his other student, Kalun. So this is the third version of the Quran. Now, the fourth version of the Quran is found in parts of Sudan, and this is called the Riwayah of Ad-Duri from Abu Amr. Abu Amr is also another reciter of the Quran. And may I also point out that Asim himself lived in Kufa and Nafi in Medina, and Abu Amr, whose qiraat I'm just mentioning, he lived in Basra. And as I said, his Quran is found in most parts of Sudan. And finally, we have the Quran of Hisham. The Riwayah of Hisham from the Qiraat of Abdullah ibn Amir. Abdullah ibn Amir was a reciter of Damascus, and he died in 118 Hijra. So these are 5 different versions of the Quran circulating in the Muslim Ummah currently. And as I said, there are the differences in these versions is not just in matters of pronunciation or accent, but it also relates to differences in word patterns, differences in nouns, different in a singular or plural noun, and similarly in declensions or arab. And then there are differences in particles also. For example, at places we'll have waw or a fa in a difference of opinion. And just to give you an example, that the differences which are found in various versions. So, for example, if I categorize these differences, although these categories which I have made are not exhaustive, but some of the categories which can give you some idea of these differences is that in one version we find the words, as you can see being displayed on your screen, فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ هُوَ الْغَنِيُّ الْحَمِيدُ. And in the other version we'll find فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ الْغَنِيُّ الْحَمِيدُ. So we find the word huwa is missing in one of them. Similarly, there is this difference in singular and plural nouns. So the first of these verses which I cited was Surah Hadid's 24th verse. And now I will cite Surah Tahrim's 12th verse. And the words of this verse in one of the versions is وَصَدَّقَتْ بِكَلِمَاتِ رَبِّهَا وَكُتُبِهِ وَكَانَتْ مِنَ الْكَانِتِينَ. And the words in another version are وَصَدَّقَتْ بِكَلِمَاتِ رَبِّهَا وَكِتَابِهِ. وَكِتَابِهِ. In the previous we had the plural kutub and now we have kitab. وَكِتَابِهِ وَكَانَتْ مِنَ الْقَانِتِينَ. And then we have also the differences in verb patterns. For example, in one verse of Surah Araf, which is verse 141, the words are is anjaynakum min ali fir'auna yasumunakum su'al azab yuqattiluna abna'akum. And in another version the words are yaqtuluna abna'akum. And then again we have a difference in declensions or the Arab. And in Surah Lahab, the fourth verse reads in most versions as hammalatal hatab fi jidiha hablum min masad. Why some versions say hammalatul hatab, so it is declined in the nominative, while the first one is declined in the accusative. So all in all, we can see that there is a difference in these areas. And if you ask me that does this difference change the meaning of the Quran as well, I will say yes. In many cases, it does change the meaning. And although the change might be very minor and it might not be of much significance, but again, it does change the meaning. And in some cases, there is a drastic change in meaning as well. For example, in the tayammum or in the wuzu verse of Surah Maida, which is the sixth verse of Surah Maida, if it is read in a particular way during ablution, we would not need to wash our feet. To wipe them would be sufficient. To do masa on them would be sufficient. So if we read the verse as arjulakum ilal karbain, the way it is found in some of the versions, then we'll have to wash our feet. But if we read it as arjulakum, then we would not need to wash our feet. Merely wiping them or doing masa on them would be sufficient if we are doing wuzu. So you can see that there is a difference in the directives as well. Now the question which now arises is that if there are five versions of the Quran circulating in this Muslim Ummah, then which one is the correct one? Or should we say that all of them are correct? So this was the first question that struck me. And obviously, when I'll present my research, in my humble opinion, I'll present the answer to this question. But as I said, today I'm just enumerating these questions, just enlisting these questions. And the first of them, as I said, which wonderstruck me and dumbfounded me was that there are at least five versions. And I'm saying this because there are other versions also which are classically accepted. But that I leave to the next point. The next point is, the next question actually, which arose in my mind, also relates perhaps to the first question, but it is an independent question because of its import. So the second question is that there are variant multiple readings of the Quran. The Quran can be read in various ways, in multiple ways. And why? Because our scholars say that these multiple ways have been sanctioned by the Prophet. But when they say this, they do not cite any criteria from the Prophet. But what they do is they cite their own criteria in this regard. And they say that if any reading of the Quran, any recital of the Quran is sanctioned by three criteria, then it can be accepted as a verse of the Quran. That particular recital will be a verse of the Quran. And these three criteria are very, very famous, and any person who has even a slight knowledge of the qiraat science, he knows that a qiraat or a reading should be in accordance with the rules of the Arabic grammar, and then it should be reliably traced back to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And the third criteria is that it should be in accordance with any of the Usmanic copies. So any reading, any recital which is in consonance with these three criteria is regarded as acceptable. And may I show you, viewers, that If I show you this Quran before me and I open up any page of the Quran, you'll find on its sides on the that you other variant readings of a particular verse which is mentioned in the main text are mentioned in the margins, and you can see that there's hardly a page in this whole corpus of the Quran which is devoid of any variation in this reading. And this variation in reading, again, as I said, is basically acceptable to all our scholars if these readings conform to these standards which I have just narrated before you. And viewers, also interesting is the fact that these readings, as I said, at times they do not have a very significant change in the meaning, but at many a time we have significant changes in the meaning as well. Because when words change, when we find that there is a difference in declensions, in verb patterns, in nouns, the meaning obviously changes. And just to quote a very glaring example, in again the same verse, Surah Maida's sixth verse, we find that in the case of dry ablution or tayammum, now one verse has the words awla mastumun nisa, or I would say most versions, which means that if men have had intercourse with their wives, and they find they don't find water for ablution, then they can do tayammum. However, in one of the other versions, which is one of the other recitals, which is attributed to Hamza, a famous reciter of Kufa, the words are lamastumun nisa, which means that this is only allowed if a husband has kissed or touched his wife, and then he finds no water, and then he can do dry ablution. So in lamastumun nisa, the version which says lamastumun nisa, it would mean that dry ablution is allowed in the case of sexual intercourse between your husband and wife. But in the case, if the verse is read as lamastumun nisa, that is without an alif, it would mean that it is only allowed if they have kissed or touched each other. So you can see that merely this variation produces a difference in directives as well. So the question arises that if we have to accept any recital as the Quran, the obvious question which would come in my mind would be that it has to be sanctioned by the Almighty or by His Prophet. Now, lo and behold, here we find neither the Almighty nor the Prophet sanctioning these recitals or not giving any criteria of accepting these recitals. These criteria have been formed by our scholars of the Ummah. When I say these three criteria, it means that these three criteria have not been given to us by the Almighty, not been given to us by the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam himself. It is the scholars of the Ummah who say that any recital, any reading of the Quran, any qiraat of the Quran, if it conforms to these three standards, then it shall be held acceptable. So as I said, the question which arose in my mind is that why? Only God and His Prophet should be given or has been given or invested with this authority of regarding anything to be the Quran. So how can we regard something which a scholar of the Quran, who is perhaps 100 or 200 years, who lives 100 or 200 years after the revelation of the Quran, who has given him the authority to decide what the Quran is and what it is not? The third question, viewers, which arose in my mind is regarding certain narratives which are found in our canonical hadith books, which give us this very, very stark impression that the Quran we have today with us is incomplete. The Quran we have today with us is not complete. It is imperfect. It has something which has been left out. And I can quote many examples, but for the lack of time, I would content myself in citing two very common examples which are perhaps known to any student of the Quran who has studied the history of the Quran. So the third question, as I said, which struck my mind and which caused a lot of doubt in my mind was that we have this impression that the Quran we have today is not complete. Now, the first of these verses is the stoning verse, which is found in Bukhari. It is also found in Muwatta of Imam Malik. But the version that I am now presenting before you is a hadith which is from Sunan of Ibn Majah. And you can see that the words are very startling and which tell us that a particular verse of the Quran had been left out from the Quran, and it still exists in certain ahadith, and it was part of the Quran, but it no longer is part of the Quran. And let me also point out the fact that no other person than Umar ibn al-Khattab himself has is the person who narrates this hadith. So the words as recorded in the Sunan of Ibn Majah are, قَالَ عُمْرُ بُ الْخَطَّابِ لَقَدْ خَشِيْتُ أَنْ يَتُولَ بِالنَّعَ زَمَانِ حَتَّى يَقُولَ قَائِلٌ مَا أَجْدُ الرَّجَمْ فِي كِتَابِ اللَّهِ فَيَذِلُّ بِتَرْكِ فَرِيدَةٍ مِّنْ فَرَائِضِ اللَّهِ أَلَا وَإِنَّ الرَّجَمْ حَقٌّ إِذَا أُحْسِنَ الرَّجُلُ وَقَامَتِ الْبَيِّنَةُ أَوْ كَانَ حَمْلٌ أَوْ اِعْتِرَافٌ وَقَدْ قَرَأْتُهَا الشَّيْخُ وَالشَّيْخَةُ إِذَا زَنَيَا فَارْجُمُوهُمَا أَلْبَتَّةَ رَجَمَ رَسُولُ اللَّهِ صَلَى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَسَلَّمْ وَرَجَمْنَا بَعْدَهُ. Umar ibn al-Khattab said, I fear that time will pass over people until someone will say, I do not find the words of stoning in the Book of God. So in this way, people will be led astray by abandoning a directive from other directives or from among the directives of God. Bear in mind that stoning is the rightful punishment for a married person who has committed adultery. And it is established through evidence or pregnancy or confession. And I have read, Ash-shaykhu wa shaykhatu iza zanaya farjumuhuma al-battata. This is the verse which Umar said has been left out from the Quran. And it means, necessarily stone to death the married man and the married woman guilty of adultery. So this is what the conventional translation of this word is. God's messenger stoned criminals for this crime, and so did we after him. So this is the verse of the Quran, which is operational today, on the basis of which punishments are given today by our conventional scholars, the way they understand it, but it is no longer found in the Quran. Another example here is the suckling verse, and this hadith I cite from the Sahih of Imam Muslim. And here this hadith has been cited by none other than Aisha radiallahu anha. So the words are, An Aisha ta annaha qalat, kana fima unzila min al-Qur'an, ashru raza'atin ma'lumat, yuharrimna, summa nusikhna bi khamsin ma'lumat. Fattuwuffiya Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, wa hunna fima yuqra'u min al-Qur'an. Aisha stated, Among what was revealed in the Quran was that 10 known suckling drops of milk of a child will make him a foster son and hence make him prohibited to marry. Later, this was abrogated in a verse which mentioned 5 known drops. God's messenger died, and the verse which mentioned these 5 drops was among what was being read from the Quran. So Aisha radiallahu anha is supposedly saying that what makes a person as a foster son or a foster child is a suckling verse which says that 10 drops of milk when they are drunk by a child, then he becomes a foster child. And she says that this was abrogated by another verse in which instead of 10 drops, it was mentioned that 5 drops of milk are sufficient to make a child as a foster child. And what she says, which is something which is very eye-catching, is فَتُوُفِّيَا رَسُولُ اللَّهِ صَلَى اللَّهِ عَلَيْهِ وَسَلَّمَ وَهُنَّا فِيمَا يَقْرَوُ مِنَ الْقُرْآنِ فِيمَا يُقْرَوُ مِنَ الْقُرْآنِ. She says that the Prophet died, and this verse was among those that was being read from the Qur'an. And viewers, we know that today's Qur'an no longer contains this verse. So the words are وَهُنَّا فِيمَا يُقْرَوُ مِنَ الْقُرْآنِ. These verses from among the Quran when the Prophet died, and we obviously, as I said, these no longer exist. So these two are very prominent and glaring examples which testify to the fact that the Quran which we have today, if we go by these narratives, is incomplete. So as I said, this was the third question which struck me when I began my research. The fourth question which confronted me in this regard was that as I read through various research manuals and histories of the Quran, I found, and obviously this is something which is of established nature, that the Quran we have today has scribal errors, scriptural errors, errors in the script. And we find that these are numerous. Thus, for example, we have extra vowels mentioned in various places which are regarded as redundant. They are written, but they are regarded as redundant by the oral tradition. We have extra alifs, We have extra yaws and we have extra vavs. And just to give you a few examples as they are being displayed before you on the screen, this is verse of Surah An-Naml has extra alif contained in it. The words are لَعَزِّبَنَّهُ عَزَابًا شَدِيدًا أَوْ لَأَزْبَحَنَّهُ. As you can see, the underlined word, the alif, which actually succeeds the other alif, is an extra alif because the word is لَأَزْبَحَنَّهُ. Or if we don't accept this to be a letter which is redundant, then we find this anomaly that this word would disperse or this word would read in a very opposite way, and the words would be awla azbahannahu. It will be a negative particle instead of presenting the positive picture. Similarly, another example is from Surah Al Imran. This is verse 158, and here again we find an extra alif. The words are وَلَئِمْ مُتْتُمْ أَوْ قُتِلْتُمْ لَإِلَى اللَّهِ تُحْشَرُونَ. The first of these alif is, or the second of these alif is redundant, and it has to be subtracted from reading or deleted from reading, otherwise we'll have an opposite meaning. لَإِلَى اللَّهِ تُحْشَرُونَ would mean that it is for sure that people shall be gathered before the Almighty. But if we read it with the second alif as well, then the words would become La ilallahi, and we shall not, people, or you should not be gathered before the Almighty. So you can see there is an exactly opposite meaning. And the question is that scholars generally say that the oral tradition shall rule the written tradition, and these scribal errors shall be regarded or shall be disregarded. But again, the question arises that was not the Quran checked for these scribal errors whenever it was written, or should we say that the oral tradition perhaps was correcting the written tradition, or the interesting scenario that it was the written tradition which was correct and the oral tradition which was wrongly reported. So all these questions do arise. But as I said, this is just one example. Another example, this time I'll confine myself to a single example, is the existence of an extra ya. So you can see the word of Surah Zariyat before you, the verse 47. The words are وَالسَّمَاءَ بَنَيْنَاهَا بِأَيْدٍ وَإِنَّا لَمُوسِعُونَ. The word aid obviously means hand. You can see that there are two yas in that word. It should have had only a single ya, but we find that there are two yas. And strangely enough, and quite amusingly, we find some of our mufassirun, some of our exegetes saying, since the hand of God is being referred to here, so therefore we have two yas here. Obviously, this is something of more of an amusement than anything which can be nearer to reality. And the third example yours in this is that we find an extra vav mentioned in many places. And a single example that I'm going to quote before you is verse 45 of Surah Araf, which is being displayed before you. As you can see, the words are Sa'urikum daral fasiqin. And the vav here after in Sa'urikum is redundant, is has no basis. It is just there and it has no function. So you can see, viewers, that these are just a few examples which I have given. Other than these examples, there are numerous examples in which we can see these scribal errors in which an extra wa or extra ya or an extra alif is found in these versions of the Quran. And it is not just the Quran that we have today. Even the earliest versions of the Quran have these scribal errors. So the question, obviously, which arises in our mind is that why does the Quran have these scribal errors? Now, the fifth question which arose in my mind at that time when I conducted my study and studied more deeply this subject was that we know that in the times of the Caliph Usman, رضي الله عنه, he had made copies of the Quran and he had sent them to various parts of his empire so that his duty as a disseminator of the Quran, he can fulfill that duty. Now, viewers, I was struck by this question because our source books say, almost all of them say, that these versions or these copies of the Quran, which Usman made in his times, were different from each other. Now, the story goes, or the traditional account says, that Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu had collected the Quran in his times in a single volume, and Usman radiallahu anhu in his times, he summoned that copy, and then he made further copies from that copy. Now, one would obviously expect that if copies are being made from a Quran, then they have to be true copies. They have to reflect exactly what the original copy said. And we also know that the original copy was a single version of the Quran. But we are struck again by this question. But when Usman made these copies, radiallahu anhu, there were variations in these copies. There were differences in these copies. They were not reflecting what the original Quran of Abu Bakr had written in it. But we find that there are variations. And I counted once that there are at least 60 variations between these various versions, as they have been given to us by our worthy scholars. And just to give you a few examples, it is said in the Kufan and the Basran codex of the Quran, which Usman sent, the words of Surah Baqarah's ayat, verse 132 are, وَوَصَّى بِهَا إِبْرَاهِيمُ. The words are, وَوَصَّى بِهَا إِبْرَاهِيمُ. However, in the Medinan codex, the words are, وَأَوْصَى بِهَا إِبْرَاهِيمُ. Again, we find this difference, this variation. So the question is, what exactly was written in Abu Bakr's version? Was it Wassa or was it Awsa? If it is Wassa, why was another copy made with Awsa? And if it was Awsa, then why was a copy made with Wassa? And obviously, viewers, we could not have seen both these words written on that Quran, because we find that Abu Bakr's version was of basically a single Quran or a single version of the Quran. Similarly, viewers, in the Madinan and the Basran codex, the words were وَوَسَّنِ الْإِنسَانَ بِوَالِدَيْهِ حُسْنًا. However, in the Kufan codex, which Usman sent to Kufa, the words were وَوَسَّنِ الْإِنسَانَ بِوَالِدَيْهِ إِحْسَانًا. So in the Basran and the Madinan codex, the words were husna. The last word was husna. And in the Kufan codex, it was ihsana. And again, another example, in the Iraqi codex, the words were هُوَ الَّذِي يُسَيِّرُكُمْ فِي الْبَرِّ وَالْبَحْرِ. But in the Syrian codex, the words are هُوَ الَّذِي يُنْشِرُكُمْ فِي الْبَرِّ وَالْبَحْرِ. So we have a difference of words. In the Iraqi codex, the words were يُسَيِّرُكُمْ. And in the Syrian codex, the words are يُنْشِرُكُمْ. So this was the fifth question which confounded me, that why were copies of the Quran in the times of Usman different from one another, and he even sanctioned them. The sixth question which arose in my mind at that time was that basically the accounts of the collection of the Quran and its transmission have been mentioned in our Ulumul Quran books. And these Ulumul Quran books obviously reflect our history. But then again, these Ulumul Quran books are basically recounting what our initial hadith books what has been mentioned in these hadith books. That's, for example, Imam Bukhari's Al-Jami'u Sahih or Imam Muslim's Al-Jami'u Sahih and the rest of the six rest of the canonical books, whatever has been mentioned in them, they are basically our sources of the collection of the Quran narratives as well as its transmission. But when I studied the accounts or the history, earliest histories of Muslims, in particular of the Tabqat of Ibn Sa'd, who died in 230 Hijra, then the Al-Ma'arif of Ibn Qutaybah, and similarly Tabri's Tariq, I found these are the three earliest of Muslim histories. I found that there was an absolutely lack of corroboration from these accounts. And when I say this because that all these books, in particular the Tabqat of Ibn Sa'd, it mentions the biographies of all the famous companions. It mentions the biographies of people who figure in the collection of the Quran narratives, people like Usman, people like Umar, radiallahu anhu. Similarly, we find Hafsa, radiallahu anha. We find people who had been assigned the task of collecting the Quran, like Zayd ibn Sabit, Abdullah ibn Zubair, and others. We have biographies of all these people. We have the biography of Huzaifa ibn al-Yaman, the famous general of Usman, who had actually reported differences in reading the Quran. But what fails to find mention in all the biographies of all these people in these books is that they had nothing to do with any collection of the Quran role which they have alleged to play in our hadith books. So this is a question which became a question mark in my mind, that why is it that hadith books report a collection and transmission story or history of the Quran, and this collection and transmission history should have found mention in our history books as well, because these history books actually they relate and narrate the biographies of people who were involved in collecting and transmitting the Quran. But when we find these people being mentioned in our history books, in particular, I'm referring to the collection of the Quran narratives and the people who were involved in this in the times of Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu and Usman radiallahu anhu, we do not find that these people had any role which our hadith books have portrayed regarding these people. So this is my sixth question, which arose in that time. The seventh question which arose in my mind was that the chains of narration of our of these collection of the Quran narratives are extremely weak, and they more often than not, in most cases, they hinge on a single narrator, a single person from whom it is disseminated. In the first couple of tiers, it is narrated by single people. Now, it is a very common established norm of historical criticism that when things of all pervasive nature are mentioned by a few individuals, then they come to question. When the nature of something is such that it has to be transmitted, or it should have been transmitted by many people, but we find just a single person narrating it, and after him, a single person narrating him as well, then it comes to question that did this event actually take place or not? Because if it had taken place, there would have been multiple people reporting the same version, the same event. Whereas in most cases, as I shall point out in my later lectures and talks, that they all hinge upon people, single people, and single strands who report these narratives. So it is this weak nature of this transmission that struck me when I was doing my research. The eighth question which arose in my mind was that there is a serious and a severe difference in the reporting of the collection of the Quran in the Sunni and the Shiite books. We have absolutely different Sunni and Shiite accounts of the collection of the Quran. The Sunni accounts regarding the collection of the Quran have a different version of this collection, and the Shiite accounts, which are primarily based on the Kitab of Sulaym ibn Qais, Tabrisi's Al-Ihtijaj, and Ali ibn Ibrahim Al-Qummi's Tafsir Al-Qummi, the way these books describe the collection of the Quran, and obviously they point out that it was Ali رضي الله عنه who was the first person who had collected the Quran, had he brought it over to the Sahaba, the companions who were gathered at the Saqifah of Bani Sa'idah, busy in electing the next caliph or the successor of the Prophet, when he had come over to them and presented the Quran, which was with him, and he had said that it was given to him by the Prophet, and he had collected it, and he has brought this before them. But it was not accepted by the companions, as the Shiite sources say. And the Sunni sources, on the other hand, present a very incomplete picture, and they reject this, or they have a different version of how Ali was involved in this collection of the Quran. And according to them, it was Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu who, after the death or demise of the Prophet, when there was a battle of Yamama going on between Musaylimah ibn Kazzab and a number of reciters of the Quran had died, did he embark upon the first collection of the Quran as he was advised by Umar radiallahu anhu. So we find two conflicting versions in two of the mainstream sects of Muslims. Now, the ninth question which arose in my mind was that a famous companion of the Prophet, Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, he is someone who was very close to the Prophet, one of his earliest companions. Now, he is a person from whom you could least expect what I'm going to just narrate before you. He said that the Mu'awwizatayn, or the last two surahs of the Quran, Surah Falaq and Surah An-Nas, they do not belong to the Quran. It was his view that these two surahs were not part of the Quran. And as it has been reported, that Kana Abdullah yahukkul Mu'awwizatayn min masahifihi, that he would delete the Mu'awwizatayn, the last two surahs of the Quran, from the Masahif. وَيَقُولْ إِنَّهُمَا لَيْسَتَا مِنْ كِتَابِ اللَّهِ تَبَارَكَ وَتَعَالَى. He would say that they do not belong to the Book of God. So this is what Abdullah ibn Mas'ud would say, as has been recorded by our hadith books. Now, the tenth question which arose in my mind was regarding the arrangement of the surahs in the companion codices. Now, as you can see, the order of the Quran Quranic surahs in Abdullah ibn Masud's codex and of Ubay ibn Ka'b's codex is being displayed before you. And this has been brought to surface by Ibn Nadim's Al-Fahrist and Suyuti's Al-Itqan. And they have displayed this arrangement in their own books and said that this is how the Quran was arranged in the companion codices. Again, this question struck me that if the Quran had a different arrangement and different companions, and the Quran of Usman again had a different arrangement, then which is the correct arrangement? Why should we give up the arrangement of the other Sahaba and we stick to the arrangement which is found in the Codex of Usman رضي الله عنه? So the numbers that you see, viewers, being displayed before you are the numbers which are found, are the number of the surahs. They represent, each number represents a surah in the Usmanic Codex. So these numbers actually are the surahs which are the Usmanic surahs. And the way they have been arranged in these two codices of Abdullah ibn Masud and Ubay ibn Ka'b respectively, you can see how starkly this arrangement is different in their codices. Now, the 11th question which struck my mind is that the orthography of the Quran, or the orthographic history of the Quran, in which vowel sounds and diacritics were inserted and the way it has been mentioned, it actually belies common sense. And the history which is generally recorded in various orthography books is that the vowel sounds were in the, first of all, it is said that the text written, the earliest text, was devoid of vowel sounds and was also devoid of diacritics. That would mean that the way a word should be pronounced and the way a word actually is, similar words which differ with each other by virtue of diacritics, this would not be available, it would not be apparent in that skeletal text. It is said that the vowel sounds were inserted first, and then later on, in the times of Hajjaj ibn Yusuf, the diacritics were inserted. So Abul Asfad al-Duwali is the person who first inserted the vowel sounds, and later on, about two or three decades later, Hajjaj ibn Yusuf in his time summoned some of the other people who actually then inserted diacritics. Now, the common sense question which came to my mind is that should it not have been the reverse? Because diacritical marks, or the nukat, they are an inseparable part of a letter. If at all any insertion had to be made, it should have been the diacritics which should have come first, and then later on these vowels should have come. Because merely inserting the vowels and not being able to differentiate between a ra and a za, and a ta and a za, and a seen and a sheen, or a sa and a sha, what good would have been vowel sounds? What good have been the arab if, in the absence of these diacritics, the Quran could still be read in various ways? So, in my mind, the history of this history of the orthography of the Quran, the script of the Quran, presented a very, very strange question. To me, the diacritics should have been inserted first, and then these vowel sounds should have been inserted, if at all the story, the way it has been narrated in our books, is true. So this is what the question that struck my mind, and it formed the 11th question. Now, the 12th question which struck my mind and which also caused doubt in my mind was that famous narrative, which most of you would be knowing, is the revelation of the Quran on 7 ahruf. It is said that the Quran has been revealed on 7 ahruf, and this again, this narrative is found in Bukhari, it is found in Muwatta, it is found in... Its variations are so many that most of our scholars regard this narrative to be mutawatir. They say that it is a mutawatir hadith. And strangely, not a single person is in a position to decipher what actually is the meaning of this narrative. We find different opinions, a plethora of opinions, people citing over 30 interpretations of this narrative. And a person of the caliber of Imam Suyuti has said that this narrative is among the mutashabihat, the meaning of which is only known to God. And viewers, this narrative is one of the basic narratives in Muslim transmission and collection Quran history, because it is this narrative on the basis of which multiple readings of the Quran are accommodated and allowed. And lo and behold, we find that our Muslim scholars, they have different opinions regarding this narrative. When it is said that the Quran was revealed on 7 ahruf, it is we are not in a position to definitely say what this aruf means and what the word or the letter 7 or the number 7 refers to. Thus, for example, some very common interpretation is that some people say that the 7 aruf are 7 ways of pronouncing a word. Some say that there are 7 types of Quranic verses. This is what the meaning of 7 aruf is. Other people say that 7 denotes 7 dialects of Arabia. Some other people say that 7 aruf denotes 7 different types of Quranic verses, and so on and so forth. And we have even scholars who say that it denotes 7 synonyms of the Quran. So there are so many different versions of interpretation of this narrative, and it is so central to the collection and transmission of the history of the Quran, and finding so much diverse opinions and people who have different opinions regarding this narrative and still accepting it to be a central narrative in the collection and transmission of the history of the Quran, in spite of accepting the fact that we are not very sure what it means, is again something which really dumbfounded me. Finally, viewers, the 13 question, and I would say that these are some of the questions which I am citing before you. There are several others as well which came to my mind, but these are some of the ones which I would present before you. So the final question which came to my mind was that we are generally introduced and told that the Quran was transmitted in such a manner that there were thousands of memorizers of the Quran. There were heaps, and there were such a large number of people who had memorized the Quran partially and completely. And then these memorizers had transmitted this memorized Quran to the next generation, and so on and so forth. And such was this large number of memorizers of the first generation in the time of the Prophet that any transmission of error was rendered as secure. But on the contrary, we find a Muslim hadith book as highly regarded as the Jami' al-Sahih of Imam Bukhari, presenting two narratives which say that actually there were only 4 memorizers of the Quran who had memorized the Quran in the lifetime of the Prophet. And this is obviously in stark contrast with the claim that there were thousands of memorizers. The words of this narrative as recorded in the Jami' al-Sahih of Imam Bukhari are, it is reported by Anas ibn Malik. He says, مَاتَ النَّبِي وَلَمْ يَجْمَعِ الْقُرْآنَ غَيْرُ أَرْبَعَ. And then he names those 4 persons: Abu Darda, Mu'az ibn Jabal, Zayd ibn Sabit, Abu Zayd. So it says that these are the 4 people. Only the style is very restrictive. It says, لَمْ يَجْمَعِ الْقُرْآنَ غَيْرُ أَرْبَعَ. Only 4 people had memorized the Quran. I'm saying memorized because most of our scholars interpret this narrative, the word jam'a, to connote memorization. So in the presence of this narrative that only 4 people had memorized the Quran, the claim that thousands and thousands of memorizers were there who had memorized the Quran and then transferred to the next generation, this contradiction has to be resolved. Either the first one is correct or this is correct. So again, this was a question that struck my mind, and it urged me to find what the truth was. So viewers, this is a summary of some of the questions which I have presented before you, and inshallah, in the next session, I will further elaborate on how I have taken upon myself to research out these questions, and I will also outline the methodology of my research, also give the justification and the nature of my research, and also present a summary of the topics that I will cover in my later lectures. And I pray to God that He grant me the sagacity and the wisdom and the power of speech to properly present this research before you. And I also pray to God that this research, whatever truth has come to my mind, that I should accept it the way it has come before me. And I also pray to God that this truth which I propagate, I shall always be flexible, that if any critique comes upon it, it convinces me, I shall change my opinion and always try and see what the truth is in this regard. أقول قولي هذا واستغفر الله لي ولكم ولسائر المسلمين والمسلمات.